White Sox, though, lost to the Blue Jays 2-1. At Simmons Field last night, the Kingfish beat the Lakeshore Chinooks 16-0. An afternoon game is on tap today at Simmons. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Quiet weather for the next couple of days. Partly sunny, a high of 68. East winds up to 10 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy tonight with a slight chance of some light rain, a low around 55. Partly sunny and warmer tomorrow, a high of 75. The expanded forecast, a chance for some showers and storms Friday night and actually right on through the Sunday. Temperatures rising into the low 80s by Sunday. Right now, 53 in Lake Geneva, 56 in Kenosha. Winds are light out of the northeast. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's morning show, we're going to be talking with a good friend to WGTD and a frequent guest on the morning show, Linda Guy. And Linda Guy is part of the Four Seasons Garden Club here in Kenosha. And their biggest public event of the year is Kenosha's Secret Garden Walk, and we'll be talking with her about that in just a moment. In part two of today's program, we're going to be talking about an event coming up on Sunday. The Secret Garden Walk is on Saturday. On Sunday, an event called Artistic Expression, sponsored by NAMI of Racine County, in which the artwork of various people contending with mental illness are on exhibit and on sale. And we'll be talking with a couple of people involved in that event. We'll round out the hour with a fun interview from the archives with ABC News's Dan Harris and a conversation about his recent memoir. So we have a busy day here on the morning show. Let's start by welcoming back to the program Linda Guy from the Four Seasons Garden Club. Good to have you back, Linda.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And we have, of course, this lovely event to talk about, the Secret Garden Walk in Kenosha, coming up this Saturday, the 11th of July, from 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. And, of course, I always have to take a quick peek at the extended forecast.
Oh, no, don't do that just yet.
Okay. So we'll hope that it's a decent day and actually hope it's a beautiful day to get out into Kenosha and look at 8 different gardens this year. First of all, for listeners who aren't already acquainted with this event, explain the name. What makes these secret gardens?
Well, for the most part, they are first and foremost all private gardens. These are homeowners who have developed their garden over the years, but they are also not necessarily available for public view. We have only one garden on this year's tour that's located on a corner, which means you can peek over the fence if you choose to and see this garden. But the rest of them, and this is what we usually search for, are gardens that have lovely, perfectly maintained homes from the front, but in the back is just a paradise that you have no idea is there when you drive by on the street. Hence the secret garden. And so they are backyard gardens that you would not ordinarily have access to. And on this one day, our homeowners have been generous enough to share their work and share their yard and share their expertise and take a little bow, too.
How long has this event been going on?
I believe this is our 13th year.
Hmm. And I know that one of the things you wanted to be sure to do before we're done, and maybe we'll just allow you to do this right now, is to acknowledge the really hard work of someone who has been chairing this event for 10 years now. And it's really under her guidance that it has grown as impressively as it has.
Yeah, exactly. Laura Sherrick has been the chairman of this event for the club for the last 10 years. And in that time, this has grown into a phenomenal event, not just for the club, but for the city as a whole. People do look forward to this year after year. And under Laura's direction, it has grown. It has expanded. You notice our raffles that we do at each and every house. She personally started that, got the cooperation of various garden centers and florists around the area. And Kenosha loves its raffles. Mm-hmm. So we've got beautiful live planters that are raffled off at each house. That was Laura's inspiration. But beyond that, it's the just the organization of an event this size it takes a whole lot of work that so many people and even some of our members are really not aware of how much work goes on behind the scenes and what Laura's accomplished over the years. And I just like the opportunity to give her a little shout out and congratulations on a job well done. She's got a crew of people that she's turning it over to next year, and we're hoping that it's one of those situations where the work of one person is going to be covered by the work of co-chairs next year and a larger committee. And, you know, we all have realized just how much work is involved in this and how much Laura's taken on herself over time. And so this is her baby, and we're going to try and take real good care of it for her next year.
Excellent. So it's 8 gardens that people can visit this coming Saturday on this year's Secret Garden Walk. And one of the things you were mentioning is that unlike typical years where you have one on the north side and one on the south side, or they tend to be to some extent scattered, the gardens are all really close to one another. Just how close?
We've worked for years to get them as close together as possible. Obviously, people who are doing a tour like this would like to spend the majority of their time in the gardens as opposed to in the car driving to and from. So we've established, you know, our north side tour. Last year, all the gardens were on the north side, north of Washington Road. Or a south side tour. We've done tours that primarily are in Pleasant Prairie. But this year, we've actually got, like you said, 8 gardens as opposed to the usual 6. But they are so close together. There's a couple of twofers in the group, next door neighbors, who are have both opened their gardens to us. And then there's also two that are directly across the street from each other. All of these gardens are within a 1-mile radius of on the south side of town. Kind of to just for people who know the area, we can call it kind of West Isitz and spilling into the area just west of there. So, but again, within a 1 mile radius, and if you got a good pair of sneakers, you can actually walk this garden walk.
Very good. I know that you have a couple of gardens that are returning to the tour, and one of them has a particularly interesting story, and that's the garden of Don and Mary Christman.
Right.
This is a garden which, in a sense, has returned from what they call in their little summary, trauma.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we titled this one Resurrection and Renewal. The Christmas, we're on the tour, I believe, in 2006, right about then, maybe a little bit later. And it was a year or so after they're on the tour. This is a home on 43rd Avenue in Beverly Woods, and it's a lovely, lovely garden. But a year or so after they were on the tour, they had a house fire. It started on the back deck, one of those barbecue grill situations. And they lost not only the deck and, you know, severe damage to the back of the house, but by the time the firemen and the hoses and the water and, well, the fire itself was done, a good part of the garden had been destroyed in the process. So this is a garden that has literally risen from the ashes, and they've done a lovely job of weaving the new garden into the old and doing some new things along the way. And it's once again a beautifully well-done garden and just seamlessly recreated and like I said, woven into what was there before.
Excellent. So, I know that one of the gardens, I think it's the one at the home of Ron and Karen Knauts, actually has a pond in the backyard, and so they've incorporated that pond in sort of the planning of their garden, and I suspect that's a spectacular sight.
This is an unusual garden for, this is just a standard city lot, and this lady, she's the gardener in the family, has done a fabulous job of doing just as much as she can with this space. And yes, it's one of our smaller gardens, but she has incorporated a pond into it. In fact, I believe this is the only pond on the tour this year. So I know we always get a lot of pond lovers on this tour, and they'll be looking for this one. And it's quite well done, but it shows people what can be done with just a minimal amount of space.
Another garden that belongs to the Miserellis, Mike and Debbie, is evidently, according to them, patterned after the historic gardens of Savannah, Georgia. So for those of us who've never been to Savannah, what does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you, I think what they've accomplished here is the kind of the restful, lazy, southern attitude as much as the look. They've done a lot of work with hardscape, meaning patio areas, little raised areas, trellises, and kind of creating an environment with structure and their hardscape. Their plantings, obviously, were restricted by what will grow in our northern climate here. So it's more a matter of creating that environment through the hard structure as opposed to the plants themselves.
Interesting. So that's for people around here, might be something that they've not seen very often.
Exactly. In fact, in that same vein, another one of our gardens, this is Alan and Jane Padlock. He has a fascination with exotics, let's call it. You'll see things in their garden that you wouldn't think would do well in our climate here. But by research and careful plant selection, you'll see cactus, and other more plants that have more of a tropical look, but yet are hardy in our environment. So you can create that lush tropical garden with a little extra work and experimentation.
Yeah, very good. I know that you were saying that you especially appreciate, on sort of a personal level, the garden at the home of Art and Deb Siegel, because it's a shade garden or woodland garden, and you have a lot of big, beautiful trees in your backyard, and so...
Well, actually, the Siegel garden, that's not our shade garden, but shade is part of the story there. The Siegel garden was a very shady environment, and then they lost a tree that was providing shade for three-quarters of their garden area. So this is a garden it's more in transition. This only happened a couple years ago. Last year was their first year exploring the possibilities of what they could do with a now sun garden.
I see.
So this is a relatively new garden.
So this would have been a shade garden several years ago.
It would have, yes. And now it's what can we do with all this sun? And so we try and get a good cross-section of gardens, sun gardens, shade gardens, old gardens, new gardens, small, large, and a little something for everyone. But for those of us who have, and with the emerald ash borer and that sort of thing, people are losing trees left and right. And this shows some of our guests what can be done when you're in that kind of transition and what a newer garden might look like.
Sure.
It's not going to have the look of an 8-10-year-old garden. It's fresh, it's new. So the shade garden that we do have on the tour, this is a repeat. That's Brad and Jan Weinstock's garden. They were on the tour in one of the earlier years. They have a woodland garden. This was a situation where after battling shade for years, they said, you know what? Okay, the oak trees win. Let's turn it over to the shade and just work with that and enjoy it. They've made a few changes since they were on the tour last also. But it's, like you said, for people like me who battle shade all the time, it's a peek into what can be done if you stop battling and just work with it.
Very good. The last three that we have to talk about include a real sweet story by Joanne Annan, in which she apparently has thought a lot about her own mother and her love of certain things as she put this garden together.
Exactly. There's all different reasons for gardening or gardening the way you do or what you plant, and this was a garden that she established with her mother when her mother was living with her in the house, and kind of designed it around the taste of the two of them. And her mother is in a retirement home now, but she's continued to maintain the garden and the flowers that her mother also enjoyed. And of course, as a gardener, she also surrounded her mother with beautiful flowers in her new location. But she too is rather fond of exotic blooms, and she has some quite large mandevilla plants and some sword ferns that are again very tropical, and her way of wintering those over, and a lot of us have battled this over the years too. What do? Move them down the basement and cross your fingers, whatever. But these giant mandevilla plants, they spend the winter over at Anton's greenhouse.
Oh, okay.
And then Anton's brings them back in the spring, and they've just thrived under those circumstances. That's one of our twofer locations. Her next door neighbor is the Bilotti's, and the challenge in their garden has been an excess of water that they're in this cul-de-sac where these two homes are located. The Bilotti property gets a lot of drainage from other properties that adjoin them. So she has, over the years, learned to deal with her little marshy areas along the lot line and plant with that in mind.
And I suppose that's one benefit to this garden tour is that you can visit a garden that, in a sense, exists under the situation that you have in your own garden. You can learn a lot by what somebody else has done in terms of contending with
exactly
too much water or not enough water or too much shade or not enough shade and so on.
We're all going to have our challenges. Like I said in the welcome notes, though, we gardeners, we're a resilient lot. we're accustomed to dealing with adversity, and when life hands us lemons, we plant lemon thyme.
Very good.
So this is a good example of how people have dealt with some of these things over the years.
So 8 gardens in all that people can visit at Saturday's event. And as we said, again, they are all within essentially 1 mile of each other. It's
exactly.
Even conceivable that one could walk this garden tour. And then various members of the garden club, Four Seasons Garden Club, will be stationed at each of these gardens. Do the owners tend to be there as well?
Oh, the owners love to be there. We've had very few occasions where the owners get shy and decide to leave for the day. The other thing you can count on from gardeners is that they love to talk about their work. Mm. And most of the homeowners will be there throughout the entire day and be happy to share their thoughts with any of the garden guests and help identify plants. Like you said, the members of the garden club will be stationed here and there, but we do rely on information from the homeowners. We don't know how long ago that particular plant was put in the ground. Mm. Is that what it looks like after a year, or is it going to take 7 years for me to develop that same plant? And things that they've dealt with in terms of the usual, like you said, shade and sun and, how well does that plant really survive in our climate, et cetera. So, again, something for everybody. You can always take some ideas away from the garden walk.
Remind our listeners about the ticket outlets where they can purchase tickets, which are a little bit cheaper if you purchase them ahead of time.
Exactly, yes. Tickets are $8 in advance. And if you happen to know a garden club member, she's probably got a handful of them in her purse right now. But aside from that, our ticket outlets are in Kenosha, Andrea's on 60th Street, Sunnyside Florist, 75th Street, Stein's Gardens and Gifts out on Green Bay Road, Anton's on Cooper Road on the south side, Summer's Garden Florist downtown on 6th Avenue. And then extending into the area that we've learned our guests come from, we've got Milliger's has tickets for us at their Sturtevant location, and West Dorsha Floral out in Paddock Lake, and down in Gurnee, Balmus Flowers in Gurnee all have tickets for us.
And rain or shine. And rain or shine, the event happens this Saturday, the 11th of July, beginning 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon, a completely self-guided tour in which you take these homes in whichever order you like.
Once you've got that ticket book in your hand, you can do each and every one of them in whatever order you please, whatever order you've got time for, and whatever is convenient to you.
Linda Guy from the Four Seasons Garden Club, we appreciate you joining us today on the morning show. We hope a lot of people will turn out for this year's Secret Garden Walk in Kenosha.
We look forward to seeing each and every one of them.
Thanks for being here. Here's part two of today's morning show on WGTD. The time is 8:34. We are talking about a really lovely event which is occurring on the 12th of July, an event called Artistic Expression 2015. This is just the second such event, and it is an exhibit and sale which features the artwork of various artists in a variety of mediums, but these artists have one thing in common. Each of them, in one way or another, is contending with mental illness. And of course, I think all of us know that artistic expression is one of the best ways to make one's own life better and happier. And surely there are all kinds of ways in which having a means of artistic expression can really make a difference in the well-being of somebody perhaps contending with mental illness. We're going to be talking about that, first of all, with a local psychologist, Dr. Lisa Abbott, who has joined us before on the morning show, and Allison Dorval, who is the lead coordinator for this event, Artistic Expression 2015. And again, the event is on the 12th of July in two different locations, the Coffee House in Burlington at Chestnut and Pine from 11 to 2, and then at Harry and Wanda's in Racine from 3 until 7. This event is under the auspices of NAMI Racine County. Dr. Lisa Abbott, Allison Dorval, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. Tell us a little bit about how this event got off the ground last year for the very first time. Was it the idea of somebody at NAMI Racine County or the idea of one of you? Whose idea was this?
Well, this was actually an idea that came up because I had attended similar events at NAMI Madison and NAMI Milwaukee, where they have creativity or healing arts type events. But Racine did not have anything similar to that. So I spoke with the executive director at NAMI Racine County, Dr. Boticki, and we thought it was a great idea. So we started to get it off the ground and had a great event last year, and we're ready to do our second annual this year. We've got about twice as many artists and two venues instead of one. So things are really rolling along.
Great. Is this Dr. Abbott who was just talking?
This is me, Dr. Abbott.
So did you attend one of those events or just sort of hear about it?
I had attended the events in Madison and Milwaukee as an artist. And then I coordinated Artistic Expression last year, the first annual event. And this year I am co-coordinating the second annual event.
Very good. Before we talk about the difference that being an artist and doing art and creating art can make for someone in this position, Allison, let's find out from you a little more about sort of the nuts and bolts of this event coming up on the 12th. First of all, I described it as both an exhibit and a sale. Am I correct about that?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us about the artists who are gathered and the kind of things that are going to be on display.
We have, as Dr. Abbott said, we have up to 20 different artists, and we have everything between painting, jewelry making, photography, journals, candle covers, pretty much any craft that you could conceive, we have on display, and most of that is for sale. That's up to the artist.
How did you gather these artists and their work? Are they all involved in NAMI Racine County in one way or another?
Very many of them are, yes.
One of the things we did is we advertised on various websites, such as the NAMI website and some other public posts for artists who have dealt with a mental illness and had creativity in some form of artwork. And we started that process several months ago and began gathering the applications and working through those and solidifying who we would eventually place in the event.
Dr. Abbott, you mentioned not only that you had attended a similar event elsewhere, but I think you said you actually participated as an artist. Tell us the kind of artwork which you have done and what kind of a difference it has made for you as you yourself have from time to time contended with the effects of mental illness in your own life.
Well, my artwork is less traditional. I do poetry. So some people classify that as art, maybe some people don't, but we are including poetry in our event as they did in Madison and Milwaukee. We feel it's a form of creative outlet, and for me, it's been a way to express myself when I haven't been able to explain to people particularly how I'm feeling, and it was very helpful during periods of depression in particular. And sometimes when you can share that poetry with other people who have experienced similar things and they can relate to it, it's a really positive feeling that you get in return. So I am also just kind of a writer in general. I like to write things down. It's a good release for me, kind of a nice distraction and just a fun way to help myself along when I'm going through rough times. So that's my particular form of artwork. But like Allison said, we're going to have a wide variety. We have two poets, and then we have all sorts of other artists as well.
As far as you know, have any of these artists sought out artistic expression for the first time as they've dealt with mental illness? I mean, sort of specifically or in a concerted way as a means to sort of deal with their mental illness? Or are we talking about, in other cases, artists who have always been artists? It's just right now they're artists who are also contending with mental illness. Mental illness has entered their life. I mean, how would you sort of sketch the summary for most of these artists, or is it difficult to generalize?
Well, I think that we have a number of artists who suffer from mental illness on kind of a regular basis, some of a more severe form who are dealing with it, and definitely utilize art as an outlet for them to help them cope. But we have other artists as well who are, how would you explain it? I suppose living comfortably at the moment with their mental illness, not in a significant episode or severe period in their life, but do art as some of them for a living, you know, own photography studios. We have somebody who does comic book illustrations. So we do have some kind of more professional artists who do this for a living, and we have other individuals who kind of do it as a side hobby. And like I said, some of them are currently coping with some serious symptoms and problems, and other people may be going through an easier time in their life, and things might be going smoothly. But like we know with mental illness, there's a lot of ups and downs and hills and valleys. So it could be going fine for you for a while, and then you hit some stressor or a difficult period and kind of spiral downwards. So it's hard for us to generalize from artist to artist. But I think we have a mixed batch.
Right. Allison Dorval, generally speaking, did these artists quickly and readily accept this invitation to be part of this? Or in some cases, have some of these artists, in a sense, had to be cajoled or maybe reassured that this was a good thing to do? Or by and large, have they all really eagerly come on board and are eager and excited about showing their work?
I think eager would be almost an understatement. We've had artists kind of chomping at the bit, saying, when can I do this again? When's the next one? How soon can we go? And I think for the most part, once we got the application out, they were all in within a week. They had a month, you know, to return them. So it's been a really positive draw this year.
Allison Dorval is the lead coordinator for Artistic Expression 2015, which is happening on the 12th of July. Dr. Lisa Abbott is also involved in this event, which is under the auspices of NAMI Racine County. There are a number of celebrity bartenders who are participating in the event, live entertainment provided by Mark Paffrath and others. And, of course, all of this wonderful and varied artwork from a number of different artists contending with mental illness. And the events, again, are two different venues, the Coffee House in Burlington at Chestnut and Pine. That's from 11 to 2. And then at Henry and Wanda's in Racine, and that's from 3 until 7. Artistic Expression also has a Facebook page where you can go and see photographs of some of the artists who are participating in this year's event. Coming up again on Sunday, the 12th of July, Artistic Expression 2015. The time is 8:44, and you are listening to the morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm very excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show as I speak with ABC's Dan Harris, co-anchor of Nightline, a regular presence on Good Morning America 2020, World News with Diane Sawyer, and the author of a very important new book called 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, a True Story. A really interesting book published by It Books. And for a precious few minutes, we have Dan Harris with us to talk about his remarkable story. Dan Harris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your kind words. I really appreciate it.
It's really an interesting book, and it is unlike the typical memoir or self-help book, that is for sure. You are somebody who has enjoyed great success at ABC News, but at something of a personal price, and it all came to a head on a dramatic day in 2004 when you suffered a panic attack right on the air during a newscast. It seemed sudden, quite unexpected, but in fact was a long time coming. Tell us what sort of turmoil in your life led to that really difficult moment.
Well, after I had the panic attack on the air, almost exactly 10 years ago, I went to a doctor who asked me a bunch of questions to try to get to the bottom of it. And one of the questions was, do you do drugs? And I rather sheepishly said, yeah, I do. And he said something to the effect of, okay, idiot, mystery solved. And the backstory here is that I had, after 9/11, as a young Cub reporter, volunteered to spend a lot of time in war zones, including Afghanistan, Iraq, West Bank, Gaza, Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And when I came home, I got depressed and did an incredibly dumb thing, which was that I self-medicated with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. And the doctor explained that even though my use was, you know, intermittent and short-lived, it was enough to raise the level of adrenaline in my brain and produce that panic attack.
Hmm. One of the key ingredients, and you talk about this at different points in your life, is something that had been your modus operandi for some time, something which you say you sort of picked up from your own father. He put it this way, the price of security is insecurity. How did that play out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had always operated under the thesis that the only way to succeed is to worry a lot and to be pretty anxious. And I think a lot of successful people embrace this philosophy either consciously or subconsciously, that, you know, you got to be just stressed out all the time. And the adventure in the book is really my trying to find a way to remain successful and maintain my professional edge while being happier and less stressed out. And so where I've come down on this is that there's such a thing as constructive anguish. You know, we need to be stressed out to a certain extent, but we tend to make it worse than it needs to be. And I've gotten a little bit better over time at reducing the needless rumination.
Hmm. Yeah, you mentioned this much later in the book when you're right in the middle of sort of this quest to find some happiness, some inner peace, but the concern continues to sort of raise its head that you don't want to do something that is going to, in a sense, disable you as a journalist. You pose the question to yourself at one point when you're being told all these blessings that await you if you live a more mindful life, where you wonder, wait a minute, isn't there a practical value to disquiet? I mean, you're posing the question there that if somebody gets too peaceful and everything's just fine, in a sense, aren't you disabling some of the tools which are most valuable for you as an inquisitive journalist?
And I think it's a valid question. I think it's a question a lot of people have, which is, you know, don't I need my stress in order to succeed? Isn't this what propels me forward? My to a certain extent, insecurity, my worrying, my anxiety. And my answer is yes, actually. I don't know if a lot of self-help gurus will tell you this, but yes, I actually do think you need to be, you can't, you know, float off into cosmic goo and just, you know, be completely ineffective and not care about what's happening in the world. But again, you've got to draw the line between when is the stressing useful and when is it, self-destructive and making you unhappy and unpleasant to be around. And, you know, what I found is a way to kind of, to a certain extent, draw that line effectively.
Hmm. I especially appreciate in the book how you describe so effectively, so vividly, the experience that probably a lot of people have, even if they're not a well-known journalist whose face is seen on television, namely the fact that success can sometimes be a breeder of more anxiety. And you describe, as you receive some big breaks at ABC News at a pretty young age and were, in a sense, climbing the ladder, but you write, perversely, my good fortune meant I now had that much more to lose and thus that much more to protect. And I'm sure that that's especially true when you are in a very competitive arena like television journalism.
Yeah, but I think it's true for everybody. I mean, the universality here is that our minds are insatiable. And it's not just about our careers. That when are we ever fully satisfied? Think about it. How many vacations, good meals, social encounters, romantic encounters have we had in our lives? And are we done yet? No, we still want more because the mind is never truly satisfied. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is human nature. And having a collision with that reality is, I think, a very healthy thing in the sense of the first step is admitting it.
Hmm.
And I do think that actually admitting that you are never satisfied is a profound step, a really profound step.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean that you stop pushing forward. It means that you can push forward with a certain amount of wisdom.
Right. We're speaking with ABC News' Dan Harris and talking about his really interesting book called 10% Happier. So much of your quest to be happier, or at least a little bit happier, revolves around your relationship with this voice inside your head, what you came to understand is your ego, your inner narrator. And one of the things which you came to describe as you sort of first explored this is, you said, I always assumed that the voice in my head was me, my ghostly internal anchorman, hosting the coverage of my life. And you realized that this voice inside your head wasn't exactly me, and that your ego was really stirring up a lot of trouble for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's a universal thing. Whether we're aware of it or not, our lives revolve around this nonstop conversation we're having with ourselves. We all have an inner voice, and I'm not talking about schizophrenia here. I'm talking about the voice that chases you out of bed in the morning and is yammering at you all day long and has you constantly wanting things or not wanting things, judging yourself very harshly, judging other people, comparing yourself to other people, and here's one of the hallmarks, spending a lot of time thinking about the past or the future instead of focusing on what's happening right now. And when you're unaware of this voice, It yanks you around. I mean, this is why we have our hand in the fridge when we're not hungry, or we're yelling at people when it's not in our best interest, or we're checking our BlackBerry when our children are trying to talk to us or whatever. And for me, it was what led to that most embarrassing moment of my life on national television. It was what led me to go to war zones without thinking about the consequences psychologically, to come home and get depressed and not really even be fully aware that I was depressed, and then to blindly self-medicate, all of which blew up on my face on national television.
Hmm.
So, I just think that this is, we're now talking about a central feature of human life that is all too often in our culture not really clearly articulated to us.
Right. Well, and you came to realize, in your words, you had to confront the fact that the thing I'd always thought of as my greatest asset, my internal cattle prod, was also perhaps my greatest liability. Your book is the story of your journey of sorting much of this out. And what makes your book, what gives it a wonderful, refreshing, unique flavor, is that you explore various paths in the so-called sort of self-help world, and you speak about it really honestly. And you're not afraid to kind of talk about the way in which some of these efforts came up short or were not the full answer for you. And I wonder if you could just say a word about your decision to describe this journey that you took so honestly and to speak so frankly about people that did help you but didn't completely help you, or made sense to you but didn't completely make sense to you. I mean, we don't really hear this stuff described very often in this really honest, frank way.
Well, I mean, I'll say two things about that. Well, I'll say three things. First, thank you. The second thing I'll say is that in terms of being critical of some of the self-help gurus I came across, you know, part of that was a no-brainer. I mean, I found a lot of what I discovered in America's self-help subculture to be, frankly, repellent and destructive. I think telling people you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking is not helpful, and in many ways can be damaging because it's not true. There are no magic bullets, and I think, you know, I think we're ready for a more mature discussion about happiness in America, which is why I called the book 10% Happy. And then in terms of just being honest throughout the book, I'm like really honest, and I mean, I no longer have any skeletons in my closet because they're all in the damn book, and I anguished over that for years. I mean, it took me 4 years to write the book, and I, you know, there were times when I thought it was going to destroy my reputation, destroy my career, and just be a permanent embarrassment. But as it turns out, you know, I've learned something very humbling and liberating, which is that people aren't that interested in me. These secrets that I thought were so heavy are kind of like mildly interesting to everybody else. Like, oh, okay, well, Harris is a screw-up like the rest of us. Oh, fine. What people really want to know is, what did you learn that can be of use to me? And that is, as I said, a liberating and humbling realization to me, which is it's liberating in that I think I can be honest and not risk being judged in a crippling way. And humbling because I think that, you know, everybody's the star of their own movie, and mostly what they want to know, what do you got for me?
Hmm. Well, and it probably helps that we're not living in the world of Walter Cronkite anymore. And it's hard to imagine somebody like Walter Cronkite writing a book of this self-revelatory in a sense. And now we're in an era of new openness. You have ultimately, of course, come to realize that meditation is going to play a huge role in giving you what you need. And what's so interesting about that is that you are not the typical person who subscribes to the value of meditation. And in a sense, what you're kind of saying is you are, as not a particularly spiritually minded person to start with, if meditation can be helpful to you, it can be helpful to just about anybody.
Oh, man, I am the least obvious meditator perhaps on planet Earth. I mean, I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts by a pair of skeptical scientists. You know, I had a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. So, like, there was no religion in my upbringing. My view of meditation was that it was for freaks and for weirdos and people who live in yurts and are really into aromatherapy and Cat Stevens and Ultimate Frisbee. And there was no way I was going to do it. But what turned me around was the science. There is an explosion of research that strongly suggests that meditation has an almost laughably long list of benefits, like lowering your blood pressure, boosting your immune system, and literally rewiring key parts of your brain in ways that reduce your stress and boost your happiness, and boost, by the way, your kindness. And when I heard about that, and when I heard that meditation doesn't require believing in anything or sitting in a funny position or wearing special outfits or chanting or anything like that, I decided to give it a try, just like for 5 minutes a day, and I found that it had, a significant benefit on my life. Did it solve all of my problems? Is my life a nonstop parade of unicorns and rainbows? No, but I stand by the estimate of 10% happier.
Hmm. It's a marvelous book, and I hope lots of people will seek it out. 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. A very refreshing, honest book. published by It Books by ABC's Dan Harris. Mr. Harris, I wish you happiness and peace and all else that you desire for your life, and I thank you for writing this really marvelous book.
And right back at you, and thank you for such thoughtful questions and for having me on. I appreciate it.
And the time is 8:59 as we draw to a close today's Wednesday morning show. This off the Associated Press wire. All United Continental flights in the United States are currently grounded due to computer problems. All United Continental flights in the United States currently grounded due to computer